Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today on our show, we'll hear about how Jewish communities across West Virginia are struggling to keep their traditions alive.
Kind of sad, I guess, because I feel like we used to be such a large community.
From ceremonies in a synagogue to the ingredients in Jewish cuisine, religious traditions are intertwined with culture. We'll stop by the Temple Israel in Charleston, West Virginia, to break bread for a traditional meal.
Briskets, which is a form of Friday night beef that we grew up with.
And this is my daughter, Nora. She's one. She's getting her first bite of matzo ball soup.
And we'll hear from two West Virginians who survived the Holocaust.
I worked my feet off after the war, and I was sure my dad was going to be on that list. And then finally you realize he wasn't coming back.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today on our show, we'll hear from Jewish Appalachians, a group that's not really talked about a whole lot. The Jewish holiday of Hanukkah begins December 12th and continues through December 20th. And this song we're hearing is a traditional Hanukkah song sung by Josh Barrett. He teaches Jewish music to the kids at B'nai Jacob Synagogue in Charleston, West Virginia.
This is a Hanukkah song. It's all in Hebrew. And this is a very popular song in Israel for the kids. And the kids here learn the words. And what they learn along with the words is they get to stomp at the end of the line. So the words mean, we've come to banish the darkness. In our hands are light and fire. Each of us is a small light, but all of us a powerful light. Be gone, darkness. Move on, darkness. Before the light, be gone. And they stamp when they say, be gone. Banu choshech legaresh, beyadeinu or vaesh, kol echad hu or katan, vichulanu or etan, sura choshech halashcho, sura mipnea or, sura choshech halashcho, sura mipnea or.
Today's episode was inspired by one of our listeners. Back in 2015, when we originally aired this episode, I received a message on Facebook from Kirsten Kennedy. She wondered if we had ever done an episode about Jewish Appalachians. She wrote, "I thought you may be able to let people know that we are here as well. We are small, but we are here."
Kind of sad, I guess, because I feel like we used to be such a large community.
That's Kirsten Kennedy. We invited her to the studio to tell us more about her Jewish community. She lives in South Charleston and grew up in St. Albans, West Virginia.
My mother always said we were Baptist, but we never went to church or anything like that. Like, I think I've been in a church maybe 5 times in my entire life. And so we weren't really religious.
When she got older, she felt the need to connect with her spirituality. Kirsten converted to Judaism when she was 22, and she regularly attends the synagogue in Charleston.
I have met loads of wonderful, wonderful people at the synagogue, and I love them all dearly. But unfortunately, I think all but 3 of them have been old enough to be a parent or a grandparent to me.
She's thought about moving away, not just to find a larger Jewish community, but for economic reasons as well.
It is actually kind of scary. Like, I worry because a lot of people my age are moving away for, like, school or, you know, jobs. And because of that, the communities are getting smaller. And the Jews that are still here that are my age, some of them are, I guess, falling away from religion in general. And so they don't come to the synagogue other than, like, high holidays. Not that that's bad, per se, but it's not exactly helping either. And it's kind of depressing because if we don't help keep things going, it's not going to be here.
Thanks to Kirsten's inspiration, today on Inside Appalachia, we're featuring stories from an award-winning series produced by West Virginia Public Broadcasting titled Story of the Jews in 2014, which highlights the struggles that many Jewish congregations are going through because so many young Jewish people are leaving Appalachia. Jews now only make up 0.1% of West Virginia's population. In 1899, there were about 6,000 Jews in the state, but that number has dwindled to a little more than 2,300 by 2014, according to the Jewish Virtual Library, American Jewish Yearbook. That's a decline of 2/3, while the rest of the country's Jewish population has quintupled. You see, when the West Virginia coal industry was established in the late 1800s and throughout several booming decades of the 20th century, Jewish people came to West Virginia and established businesses that supported the coal-based economy. But when the coal industry suffered a decline in the late 1950s and 60s, many Jewish families, along with many of their Gentile neighbors, left the state for economic opportunities in other parts of the country. The Jews who remain say sometimes they find cultural challenges in small Appalachian communities. It can be tough to find kosher foods or other Jews to date or marry, or Jewish education for children. It can be tough to find a synagogue. Some have closed as the Jewish population has dwindled, and some struggle to bring in young members, as Kirsten Kennedy mentioned just a minute ago. Kirsten attends a synagogue in Charleston. Rabbi Victor Yurecki has led the congregation at B'nai Jacob for almost 30 years. Roxy Todd recently sat down with Rabbi Yurecki and asked him to talk about how the ex-migration of people leaving Appalachia has affected the Jewish community in Charleston, West Virginia.
Some of the things that we are doing in order to survive and what makes our experience somewhat unique here in Charleston is we are a traditional congregation trying to maintain traditional Judaism in not just a modern world, but also a rapidly changing world. And so there's two forms of outreach that we do. One is the outreach with regards to interfaith, realizing that the message of Judaism is not just very narrowly understood as a message to be spoken to the people within our own faith, but how we interact with other members of other faiths who are interested in learning more about their faith through the understanding of Judaism. So as a result, our classes, our prayer services, which at one time were experiences only to be enjoyed by the Jewish faith. Now we open our doors. Our congregations become almost daily experiences for any member of any congregation or no congregation to come in, experience the Jewish tradition either through Torah classes, studying the Hebrew Bible, the Talmud, which is our oral tradition, or even just coming on tours. I have two this week, which shows you that this constant flow of information for people to experience and be a part of our community in other ways other than just becoming members of our community.
What about the families that have left? Are they still connected to your synagogue?
That's the interesting thing. We have, in fact, we just had a bar mitzvah, actually have two children that have moved away, but the families still remain very, very close to their roots here in Charleston. And these are transplants. These are people that moved to West Virginia, but they found a home in a very small but very inviting Jewish community. They've left. They've gone to bigger states, but those states are not as inviting. And they have not forgotten what they experienced here in West Virginia, in Charleston, specifically in our congregation. And they've asked if they could come back and have their bar mitzvahs, their weddings here. And we, of course, have a very, very open door about that. And it's created some creative opportunities for us. For example, for these children that were recently bar mitzvahed this weekend, we learned our entire lesson through the computer or on the telephone. And then they came the week before their bar mitzvah. They came to the synagogue and practiced. And we're not talking about just a couple of prayers. They did the entire service, which was rather inspiring.
And even though so many people are passing on or leaving, there are a couple people that have converted and joined the Jewish community. And one young woman in particular, she kind of reached out to us. And I know that she converted when she was in her 20s. So there are some people that are joining the Jewish faith.
We have a lot of people that join our faith. The challenge for us specifically, for me as a rabbi now that served this congregation now for over 30 years, is we are a traditional congregation, which means a lot of our practices are done in the traditional rite, all in Hebrew. A lot of the experiences are things that I wouldn't say meant more to the older generation, but they could do it where the younger generation, people that have converted, don't have that spiritual memory to be able to fully be a part of the religious experiences found in our synagogue. And that's our challenge today. Our challenge is people are coming to our congregation. They find the warmth of West Virginia. They find the beauty of tradition, but it's still not something that they can totally experience. And it's a challenge both for me, but it's also something that it's an opportunity. We have trying to figure out the expanding role for women. The synagogue is a very traditional congregation, so there is no active role for women in traditional Jewish life. In the synagogue, at home, of course. So how do we meet those challenges? How do we meet the challenges of people that love coming to prayer services, but the Hebrew is proving to be a very daunting experience for them? Not that they can't learn the Hebrew, but they're pulled in all different directions, and to ask them to also learn a lot more Hebrew, where someone who's experienced it his entire life, that's a challenge, that's a hurdle for them to overcome. So how do we make those services more meaningful to them while still maintaining our traditions? And that's going to be the challenge going forward, because we do have a younger generation that's coming. They're engaged, but their ability to be engaged is limited. And that's going to be the challenge going forward. It's a challenge, but it's an opportunity.
As I was sitting in Rabbi Yerecki's office, I couldn't help but notice his collection of comic books and comic book figurines, and even yarmulkes for kids with comic book characters on them, like Spider-Man and Batman.
But it's a reminder that religious life is just part of being human, and it's part of life. And I think that going forward, we need to make our congregations far more open, far more generous of heart, far more, I guess, natural. That it's, you know, that you walk in, you're not nervous, but you're excited about coming in. Where kids can walk in and feel that it's their home. Where an older person can walk in and they still see the traditions, but they realize that if they've, quote, sinned in the past, they're not going to be accused, but they're going to be coming in and being welcomed with open arms. So anything congregations can do to make the place warm and inviting for young and old is, I think, a plus. So that's why you see some of the crazy things that you see in my office.
There are actually two synagogues in Charleston. The one Rabbi Yerecki leads is a conservative, traditional congregation, which means many of the services here are in Hebrew, and many of the older traditions are practiced here, like the early morning service the rabbi leads every day.
It looks like you stepped into a little shtiebel, a little backwood congregation in Eastern Europe, where it was all in Hebrew. Everything from taking out the ancient scroll, reading the portion of the week, to everything being conducted in the rites that's been done for hundreds and hundreds of years. That's one experience that we still maintain here at our congregation. But what you're also starting to see are things like Jews and Brews, where we have younger generation that are meeting at bars once a month, where we all just get together and we just converse. Sometimes it could be on something very philosophical and thoughtful, and sometimes it could just be on how West Virginia University and Marshall are doing. We're starting to see those type of experiences where in the past we wouldn't be able to do those type of things or didn't think that we needed to do those things. Again, some of the traditional people, they can't relate to the Jews and Brews, but some of the people that relate to the Jews and Brews can't relate to coming to the morning traditional services. So you're starting to see those type of things. We're having casual Shabbat dinners, both ourselves as well as Temple Israel, our sister congregation that's Reform, that we just invite people to come and eat with us. They can come and stay for the service if they like. If not, they just want to come and have a meal and celebrate the Jewish Sabbath. They can do that. We have Sunday morning breakfasts. We have Saturday evening where we have Havdalah, where we say farewell to the Sabbath, and then we all go out to eat. Again, those are experiences where they can take the entire piece and see both the tradition as well as the social. Or they can just enjoy the social, or they can just enjoy the religious.
Again, that was Rabbi Yerecki, who leads the B'nai Jacob Synagogue in Charleston, West Virginia. He was speaking with Roxy Todd. So Charleston's Jewish community is still able to support two synagogues, even though their numbers are declining. Next, we travel to one community in southern West Virginia to hear how the Temple Beth El in Beckley is dealing with a population decline. Back in 2014, reporter Suzanne Higgins talked with members to find out how they're hoping to adapt to these new challenges.
It's a small temple like a little small country church. We've gotten members from out of town that have come here from a bigger community, and they maybe stayed here 10 or 15 years. And one thing about every one of them tells me, or even somebody that just walks through the door for the first time, they'll say, you know, I feel as close to God here as I've ever felt in my life.
Tom Sofer was once a teenager helping the rabbi at Temple Beth El in Beckley with maintenance and yard work. Decades later, he's president of Temple Beth El and still doing that maintenance and yard work. He tells us the small cinder block building, updated years later with a stucco exterior, was built in 1935.
At that time, there was a large group of Jewish people in Beckley, a lot of merchants, and they were conducting services like in people's homes. They were also using a few churches around the area. And then they said, you know, maybe we need to put a temple together.
The town of Beckley donated the land for the construction of the building. Throughout the 20th century and into the new millennium, Judaism has clearly been a minority religion in the southern coal fields, and those numbers continue to decline. At its peak in the 1960s, there were 60 Jewish families in Beckley alone that were active congregants. Sofer estimates the temple now has about 30 families, and those are drawn from throughout the region.
Back in the 90s, when my kids were involved in Temple Beth El, there was a nice group of kids and parents that were very active in the temple, and we had Hanukkah parties and the high holidays. The temple was full of laughter and, you know, little footsteps running up and down the aisles and those type of things. And now, in 2014, the kids have all grown up and they've gone their way. And not all of the parents come to temple on a regular basis, so...
Does that worry you?
Yes, it's concerning. But, you know, there is a core group of Jewish people in the community, and they really, really want it to work.
My name is Scott Gelman. I am the student rabbi at Temple Beth El in Beckley, and they are so excited to have me. And I am so excited to be here with them.
Scott Gelman is a second-year student at Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in Cincinnati. He drives from Ohio once a month to lead this congregation in Sabbath services, education classes, and special events. Because membership has declined, Temple Beth El hasn't been able to afford a full-time rabbi since its last and beloved rabbi, Isidore Wien, died in 2000.
So this program really enables Judaism to continue thriving in small communities. I've had experience leading services in other realms, but to be the spiritual leader of this congregation, of this incredible community, is such an honor.
Gelman explains Temple Beth El is a Reformed synagogue, a denomination of Judaism that actively reaches out to be part of the greater community.
Our ties with the Jewish community and the greater community is really shown here on the Bima, which is the stage. We have an Israeli flag, and on the other side, we have an American flag, showing that we are truly have one foot in each community.
Also on the Bima, or the stage, is the menorah, a 7-branch candelabra replicating what the Bible says was used in the Temple of Jerusalem. Also in this area, the lighted memorial boards, names of members of the synagogue who have passed away.
And actually, the synagogue does a very interesting thing that I have not seen in other synagogues. They have names of important people in the world who they feel have had an impact on the world, weren't necessarily part of the community here, but we have names like John F. Kennedy and actually Anwar Sadat as well.
And in the center, the Ark, representing the Ark of the Covenant, which the Israelites built in the desert when Moses came down with the tablets.
And so inside of the Ark, this community has two Torahs. Judaism today is not Torah law, but is extrapolations, and it is the original blueprint, but is not the blueprint for our living nowadays.
On On this cold winter's evening, with the snow steadily falling, about 15 members of Temple Beth El listened to Rabbi Gelman link a recent Jewish holiday that celebrates nature with what he called the environmental tragedy of the chemical spill in the Elk River, and then ultimately with the temple's concern about its future.
Last week, we celebrated the holiday of Tu B'Shvat, and Tu B'Shvat specifically celebrates the New Year of Trees. So this new year of trees helps us to think about the environment and its ebbs and flows, but it is still easy to take for granted what we have, that is, until it's gone. We all learned how to not take the life source that comes out of the tap for granted. This building and its community are the lifeline of the Jewish community in Beckley. We must remember that this building stands and this community thrives because of those who never took it for granted.
The congregation celebrated this evening the birthday of 90-year-old Irene Fink, a member of one of the founding families of the temple.
My name is Irene Besso Fink. I came to Beckley in 1943. My husband, Sidney Fink, family of L.J. Fink. We had the Hub and Vogue, wonderful family store uptown, and a woman's specialty shop. It just has been a wonderful community. And there's no place like Beckley, West Virginia.
That's lovely. Let me ask you, what has Temple Beth El meant to you personally? Can you talk about what this building and everything that it stands for?
Anything that is good, progressive, honest, which is very difficult to come by, continuously growing. What we learned very, very young, what the good Lord taught us. Health, nature, beauty, honesty.
I'm Kenneth Fink. I'm actually a resident of Huntington, and I came up today to both because of the traditions in the temple and to honor my mom's birthday. Even though I'm from Huntington, I have kept in touch with what goes on here, and I was born and raised here and was bar mitzvahed here, in fact, many years ago. So I have fond memories standing in the sanctuary and see a lot of names on the memorial board that I knew. Members of this community have always been active in public issues and the growth of Beckley, and certainly the congregation has diminished in numbers. As you probably know, many synagogues over West Virginia in the recent years have closed and consolidated. But I think people here have a sense of hope that somehow they'll find a will and a way, and hopefully people will return or people will gravitate here. They make a great effort to try to keep the place going, and I'm proud of them. That's why I came tonight.
So this small congregation moves forward with the doors of the temple wide open. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Suzanne Higgins in Beckley.
When we come back, we'll learn about a feast of Jewish cuisine, including matzo ball soup and more. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Looking for a rewind button? Don't worry, Inside Appalachia is available as a podcast on iTunes, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can subscribe and listen on your own time. Now we'd like to bring you some treats from the Sabbath Supper. Today we'll share a Jewish-themed Appetite Appalachia.
Cornbread and butter beans and you across the table. Eating beans and making love as long as I am able. Oh, and corn and cotton too, and when the day is over, ride a mule, a crazy fool, and love all.
Appetite Appalachia is an occasional segment here on Inside Appalachia, which features restaurants and recipes with Appalachian roots. So have you ever tasted noodle kugel or matzo ball soup? Well, if you're not Jewish, you may not know what these foods taste like unless you've attended a meal at your local synagogue. Some congregations host community gatherings that are open to the public. Back in 2015, one of these gatherings was hosted by the Women's Zionist Organization of America as a way to raise money for a hospital in Israel. As reporter Scotty White found out, the meal was also a way to share Jewish connections between food, family, and religion with everyone.
The women of the local chapter of Hadassah have been working since July to feed the community during the Taste of Jewish Cuisine held at the Temple of Israel in Charleston, West Virginia. Chapter President Lynn Meyer led the group of women on the monumental task of making 600 matzo balls, over 200 pounds of brisket, plus 34 pounds of noodle kugel, vegetables, and desserts.
We made briskets, which is a form of Friday night beef that we grew up with, long cooking. And I think probably if you were to go back to the origins of these things, most people have seen Fiddler on the Roof. They had to get things cooked before the Sabbath started, which is at sundown on Friday night and ends at sundown on Saturday night. And at no time during that time are they allowed to cook or clean or things like that.
Lynn grew up with those traditional meals, and cooking for the community brings back memories.
My mother cooked Friday night dinners, and I would do that now if any of my five kids and their families lived here. They don't. But Steve and I do it ourselves, my husband and I, and I'll always miss those Shabbat dinners, those Sabbath dinners.
For the Taste of Jewish Cuisine, Lynn also baked more than 800 loaves of challah. Challah is a bread that is typically served at the three Sabbath meals, Friday night, Saturday lunch, and Saturday afternoon. It also commemorates the manna that fell from heaven during the 40 years the Israelites wandered the desert after the exodus from Egypt. Challah is made of strands of dough woven together in a braid.
The origin of the braiding was something that I'm absolutely not positive of, but I think we all think that it started that of just intertwining your family lives together, putting the braid together so that your lives are intertwined.
Lives intertwined, much like the Taste of Jewish Cuisine was doing for the community. The room was filled with people from all walks of life, some members of the temple, but many people from the Charleston and the surrounding areas. They are smelled of fresh brisket and kugel.
My name is Isaac Foreman. I live here in Charleston. This is my daughter, Nora. She's one. She's getting her first bite of matzo ball soup. Nora, you want to say hello? No. She likes the matzo ball soup and the kugel. She didn't like the brisket, but it's a little hard for her to chew. Yeah, I think it's great to see everybody here coming out and trying the food and getting a taste of, the Jewish culture. I think it's wonderful because most of the people here are not members of the congregation. They're just people who came to eat some good food.
My name is Linda Tabarowski. I'm the past president of Ladies Auxiliary of B'nai Jacob. I love the idea that we're together as a people in all different religions and belief systems, that we can enjoy each other and learn from each other and help each other and whatever we need to do. So it just makes me happy.
Linda says that the Charleston community means a lot to her. Her family's been here for a century. Her grandparents fled from Europe in the 1900s because of the pogroms, which were attacks on the Jewish people.
They came here in the bottom of a boat. Well, my granddad did anyway. It must have been horrible down there. And the bottom of a boat jammed in with the smells, the screams, the crying, and whatever else, no food, was better than what they had in the pogroms. And they taught my brother and me, especially here in Charleston, we look over that capital, they taught us that this is the most magnificent place on earth. No, so to us, Charleston is saved us. And if you think how many things were lost over those years, and what could have been, and what we don't have to live here in West Virginia and in the United States, it's a blessed thing. So brisket's part of it. We can make our brisket and read from a Torah. Not at the same time.
And like the brisket that Linda remembers from her childhood, food connects people. The Taste of Jewish Cuisine also helps introduce these food traditions to the community as a whole. It also allows the next generation to sample their first bites of tradition. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Scotty White.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we're hearing about the ongoing struggles of Jewish communities in Appalachia, determined to preserve the traditions of their religion and culture.
About 80 years ago, the Jewish people were determined to preserve their lives after being persecuted, tortured, and executed. Next, we'll listen to stories of people who survived the Holocaust, an atrocity on a scale the world had never known before, one that continues to haunt us to this day. First, we'll hear from Daniel Kareth, who came to West Virginia as a young man and lived to be 95. He passed away a few years ago. Today, we remember Mr. Kareth, as he wanted us to remember the lessons of the Holocaust. Suzanne Higgins visited Kareth at his Bluefield home in 2011.
My name is Dan Kareth.
It's so nice to meet you. Oh, that's lovely, isn't it?
Isn't it?
What kind of flowers do you have?
African violets.
African violets? Well, you know, those are very temperamental. You must do very well with them.
The place is, they like the place.
Oh, they like the sun right
they
here.
They like the sun, see here.
Daniel Kareth is a retired librarian who worked several decades for Concord University. He walks about with effort, offering a fresh cup of coffee in his cozy kitchen in Bluefield. As National Holocaust Day of Remembrance approaches, the 92-year-old survivor says years on the run and in prison were life-defining.
It lives with me. Should I say, of course, everything becomes unimportant compared with that experience, especially that none of my family came back. So uncles, aunts, cousins, my parents, everybody, nobody survived.
Kareth was born into a Jewish family in Vienna, Austria in 1918. His father was an appraiser, his mother a shopkeeper. He had two half-sisters from his father's first marriage. He was 20 years old and working in a textile factory.
It was a normal family under normal conditions. But in 1938, when Germany was occupied by Germany, it was radically changed from one day to another. Overnight, everything changed in a horrible way. You can't imagine what kinds of Nazis did to make light long before the Holocaust started. To make life miserable. You couldn't go only in certain hours of the day on the street. You had to wear a star, yellow star that says Jew. You couldn't sit on park benches. You couldn't get to any public places. It is hard to imagine that, for example, Francis grew up with them. Otto Sutton didn't know me anymore.
When Austria voted to join the Third Reich, Jews desperately tried to leave. But before Kareth could, he was arrested and sent to a concentration camp in Austria. When the camp became overcrowded, the Germans released Kareth and told him to leave the country within 2 weeks or be rearrested.
So out of desperation, I went at night over the border into Hungary.
Kareth says he couldn't find help in Hungary, so he continued to flee to bordering Romania, on foot, with no money and just a few rations.
I can see it still today. To go over the border, I went along a river. And one side of the river was kind of a dam, an earthen dam. And I went on top of this dam, at night, of course, and out of a sudden I heard steps behind me. So I went off the side and hid over there and was waiting until this person passes me. And there came a dog and started to bark. And they had a sandwich with me and I pieced the dog with the sandwich.
Kareth found work for a few months in a mill in Romania, but eventually was deported, ending up in a prison in Palestine.
The human memory is a very strange thing. I remember when I was put in the concentration camp, like a photograph. But I was moved from there to another place, and that is what I absolutely can't remember. Totally blank. Perhaps it's good I can't.
Kareth remained in Palestine for several years following the war, living and working in a kibbutz. In 1956, he came to America, finished high school, and went on to college, earning degrees in political science and library science. But life as a librarian in New York didn't suit him.
Und er found in one of the professional journals an advertisement that said that Concord College is looking for a librarian. And it said in this ad that is healthy surrounding and so on, but really means they don't pay very much. And it really was true.
But you ended up here anyway.
They brought me down for an interview, and I fell in love with the place. That was about almost 40 years ago. I think I have a right to say I had adopted Mountaineer. After 1945, the war ended, not only I, but generally were taught that racism, anti-Semitism, intolerance will disappear, but it went dormant. And now in bad economic times we have now, it revives in full force. We have it around us. So we have to be very careful not to repeat his history. I think it is really forgive but not forget. And this is important to speak about that.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Suzanne Higgins in Beckley.
Next, we're going to hear from a Holocaust survivor who spent years educating young West Virginians about the horrors and lessons of the Holocaust. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Glennis Board brings us the story of Dr. Edith Levy.
She was born in Vienna, Austria, in 1930. She says her childhood ended 8 years later. She remembers the Jewish holiday where you celebrate finishing reading the Torah.
They dance around with the scrolls, and you try and reach, and you kiss the Torah. And my dad put me on his shoulders, and I leaned forward, and I was able to reach. And I thought I was in heaven, right? And then was Kristallnacht. And then they burned the Torahs on a big bonfire in the middle of a square. And this little kid couldn't understand that. Why can it be such ecstasy at one moment and then just be burned, and you know, and just in a bonfire?
Kristallnacht, a series of coordinated attacks against Jews throughout Nazi Germany and parts of Austria in November of 1938, carried out by paramilitary forces and non-Jewish civilians. At least 91 Jews were killed in the attack, and 30,000 were arrested and incarcerated in concentration camps. Levy says it took some time to be able to understand what was happening.
And then the Nazis took us out of school. I wasn't allowed. And that, I became aware. And also the whispering and the things between the parents. We tried to leave legally. We had passports to, Mom had a brother in Argentina, but everybody was trying to leave Austria because it was mad. Lines were way long. And they closed the consulate just before we came to the door. So then Mom had a friend who knew somebody to smuggle us over the border to Belgium. That was a horrible experience.
Levy remembers traveling one moonless night through farm and field, mud and manure, with other families also trying to escape. A rusty nail ripping her father's coat, getting tangled in barbed wire, heightened danger created by a crying baby. These are recollections that spike her memory of escaping Austria. The next several years were full of hiding and fleeing, being caught, dodging bombs, scavenging, illness, ridicule, betrayal, and occasional life-saving kindnesses. They ended up in Brussels, leading a relatively normal life for a time in 1942. That's when she lost her father.
And then Dad got the papers at first to go for forced labor. Mm-hmm. And Mom said, go into hiding. And he says, no, if I go, you and the kids will be safe, because nobody could imagine what Hitler had in mind. No, he figured he didn't mind hard work, so he went. Ultimately, in a way, it did save us. But
Levy never saw her father again. He died sometime later in Auschwitz.
Oh, I tried to find him. I worked my feet off after the war. There were lists of people that had returned. And I was sure my dad was going to be on that list. And sure, the list would get shorter and shorter. And then finally you realize he wasn't coming back.
She says at 13, she struggled to find the will to live.
I didn't want to live. After what I'd gone through, what the world, what people were capable of, were good turned to evil, you know. So I lay down on the couch, turned my head against the wall, and then one guy came and he said, okay, you don't want to eat, you don't want to live, he says, die. Give Hitler another posthumous victory. Give him another victim. And that's when I said no. That's when I got back on my feet. But I was sick. That was part of it, too.
Still, Levy lost faith in humanity and in God.
I couldn't justify it. I couldn't justify a God that would allow that to happen. And if he allowed it to happen, what kind of a cruel God was he?
But her faith wasn't long lost. As a girl, Levy remembers coming across the cover of a magazine which had pictured a very tall man. His head was next to the moon, and his feet were on the ground in boiling water.
And it said it would take him 3 days for the sensation to reach the brain, and 2 more for his foot to take out of the water. So that's the simile I took, and said, the good Lord, he's far away. He's got a lot to do, not just us. And time warp is different. So, you know, we were saved eventually. But what we consider a day is a blink of an eye for the Lord. That's what my childhood little girl decided to make out of it.
Levy eventually married an American and made her way to the United States. She and her family lived for a while in New York City, but she found the culture there unfriendly and alienating. So her husband, Mark, applied to transfer jobs, and they wound up moving to Morgantown. Levy still smiles, thinking back on the first trip to the small West Virginia town. Traveling on the old Route 119, she and her husband landed their car in a ditch at a sharp bend.
Within a matter of seconds, there were 2 cars and a truck, and it stopped. The one car pulled out a chain and pulled us out. And Mark says, there goes a 20. New York mentality, right? He tried to give the guy $20, and you have never seen anyone more offended. That is a neighborly thing to do, he says. We don't take money for that. So that's how we stayed in Morgantown.
Levy was struck by the culture of community living. She says everything from neighbors lending batteries from their cars to sometimes dropping off a brood of children unannounced. She fell in love with Morgantown. What was supposed to be 6 months turned into a home place where she and her husband Mark raised their family. It was several years later when, she says, she heard hate in the hollows. People were trying to deny the Holocaust happened. That's when Edith Levy stood up.
Hey, I know it happened. I was there.
Levy began writing. Her writings appeared in the book Flares of Memory, and she authored a textbook and curriculum entitled The Holocaust in Perspective.
There was nothing in the schools. The history book had one paragraph that mentioned the Holocaust. Who was it that said, if you don't learn from history, you're bound to repeat it?
Levy says one of her proudest accomplishments was finding the courage to stand before the West Virginia legislature to make a case for the creation of the West Virginia Holocaust Education Commission. She was 68 and still terrified of authority. Then Governor Cecil Underwood established the commission by executive order in 1998, and Levy set to work educating middle school students throughout West Virginia.
I figured if I survived the Holocaust, and if I survived the illnesses, then the good Lord had a mission for me.
Dr. Levy has since stepped down as chair of the Holocaust Education Commission. She worries that the cause will be lost without a passionate chair.
The thing of it is, as far as I'm concerned, you've got to teach that you can be good. And you don't have to be selfish and say, I don't care.
Dr. Levy is a member of the Hall of Fame of the Human Resources and Education School at West Virginia University and has received the Governor's Lifetime Achievement Award. She dedicated a Holocaust library at the Morgantown Library in honor of her father, J.D. Rector. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we've been listening to stories about the Jewish community in Appalachia. For help with the episode's soundtrack, Inside Appalachia's Roxy Todd went to the Temple Israel in Charleston to speak with Rabbi Jim Cohn. She found out that Rabbi Cohn's collection of Jewish music is vast and varied.
Most Jewish ceremonies include singing, prayers, and blessings sung in Hebrew.
This is the beginning of the Torah, the beginning of what Christians call the Old Testament, what Jews call the Hebrew Scriptures, and this is the first few verses of Genesis. Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim vet haaretz v'haaretz hayta tohu vavohu v'choshech al pnei tohom v'ruach Elohim rachefet al pnei hamayim. Vayomer Elohim yior, vayior, vayar Elohim et haor ki tov, vayavdel Elohim bein haor uvein hachoshech. I think one of the important things about music is that it touches places that words and ideas can't reach. So when you have a text that's considered sacred by a community, and you combine that with the areas of our brain and of our mind and of what we metaphorically call our heart that are not reachable simply by the text itself, you have a very powerful combination. And even for the people who can't understand the text itself, non-Hebrew speakers, the melody still reaches some inward place that is important to access. So within the context of a worship service, the music provides a dimension that isn't available through any other means.
But Rabbi Cohn wants people to know that Jewish music is more than the traditional Hebrew chants. He sets out a dozen CDs for me to sample.
I've got my ska and reggae Jewish music that I love to listen to.
Rabbi Cohn says this ska CD by King Django is one of his favorites. But there are others. Music with a swing tempo, music with a Latin American rhythm.
Jewish music is different not only depending upon the culture, the majority culture in which it's found, but also differs from decade to decade and from century to century. So music from Italy in the 17th century that's composed by Jews might be in Hebrew, but it might be sung to the motet form that was characteristic of that environment.
This piece was written in Italy in the 17th century by a Jewish composer named Salomone Rossi. Rabbi Cohn has been collecting this music for decades. He's fascinated by the way musicians are always reinventing what it means to play Jewish music generation after generation.
I love being Jewish and I love music, and to be able to integrate those two things gives a quality to my life that is deeply enriching.
And while the ska music is probably his favorite, there's one very silly one that he just had to play me right before I left.
Constant service, I've seen service all my days. I beat Shalom, the Flatbush Avenue, in old Brooklyn, where I was born and raised.
This is the Soggy Matzah Boys playing their version of Man of Constant Sorrow, Man of Constant Souris. Souris means troubles in Yiddish. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd.
This snow and sleet. So we finally moved down to Miami, and now she kvetches about the heat.
Now there was she.
And to round out our show, here's a little modern hip-hop Jewish song from the Maccabees.
Yeah, Maccabees. Just living in a miracle, candles on my vehicle, 8 nights, trying to shine invincible, no longer be divisible, born through the struggle, keep on moving through all this hustle, heads up, heads down through all of the bustle, New York City, wanna flex your muscles, look so down, look so puzzled, gotta run your fire through all the rubble, bound to stumble and fall, but my strength comes not from man at all, bound to stumble and fall, but my strength comes not from man at all.
That's our show, featuring the ongoing work that Jewish communities in Appalachia are doing to try to keep their traditions alive. Happy Hanukkah. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by Bella Fleck and Abigail Washburn as heard on Mountain Stage. Music was also provided by Ben Townsend, Rabbi James Cohn, Josh Barrett, the Maccabees, and our Appetite Appalachia music is by the Carolina Sunshine Trio. Roxy Todd and I produce Inside Appalachia. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. He also edited our episode this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Claire Hemme helped with our digital correspondence. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you can subscribe or download all of our stories for free on iTunes, Downcast, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Love, couple for a dime. Isn't it hard to see you got a choice?